Today we are very fortunate to have an outstanding speaker. So fortunate that I'm actually going to defer to my colleague Scott Gilbach in political science, who will introduce our speaker today. So I'll yield to Scott.
All right, very good. So I'm happy to introduce Joshua Tucker. Josh is a professor of politics at NYU. He's also, by courtesy, a professor of Russian and Slavic studies at NYU, which immediately raises the question of why we don't have this courtesy at UW. Josh is a leading expert on political behavior. So for those who are not in political science, political behavior, roughly speaking, you can do this better, but roughly speaking, is the study of individual attitudes, electoral behavior, collective action, and related topics. He's a leading expert on political behavior in the politics of post-communist states. He's the author of a long list of articles in all the right places, as well as the book Regional Economic Voting, Russia, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, 1990 to 1999, which was published in Cambridge University Press's prestigious Comparative Politics series. But he's more than all that. He's also one of the editors of the Monkey Cage blog at the Washington Post, which brings political science research to the general public and which all of you should be reading. And he's played a leading role in changing the way that we do political science, the way that we study politics. He's one of the founding editors of the Journal of Experimental Political Science, and as the co-director of the NYU Social Media and Political Participation Laboratory, where he has helped to bring the lab model, which is more traditional in the sciences, to political science. He's also a true friend, and it's a pleasure to have him back in Madison. Please welcome Josh Tucker.
Thanks, Scott. That's a very, very kind introduction, and it warms my heart and makes me feel slightly better for not having anything to tell you about Polish prostitutes today. So, but what I am going to tell you about is a book project that I'm working on with my colleague Grigory Popolin, which is The Effect of Communist Legacies on Attitudes Towards Social Welfare. No, Grigory Popolin at Princeton University. We've been working on this project for a long time. And here's what I'm going to talk to you about today. I want to talk to you about, I'm going to first give you the background on the overall project, where what I'm talking about today fits into our overall book project that we're working on. Then I'm going to talk to you about the theoretical framework that we've come up for studying the effect of communist era legacies on attitudes towards politics and economics in contemporary post-communist citizens. Then I'm going to talk to you about the methodological approach that we've developed for testing the hypotheses that come out of these theories. And then I'm going to show you some results, which are going to come from one chapter of the book, which have to do with the effect of attitudes towards social welfare among post-communist citizens. All right, so the project motivation. For those of you outside of political science, originally, post-communist societies were assumed to be, there was this phrase that tossed around in the early 1990s that were tabula rasas. Right? This was the absolute opportunity. You had a blank slate. You could come, write the rules down, and you would get the behavior the rules predicted. And this is, I've sort of affectionately referred to this as the heyday of economists and constitutional lawyers, right? This was the chance to come in there. Now, however, over time, this view that these were tabula rasas, that you could effectively disregard the history of the past 70 years, or the past 45 years, or the past 300 years, and think if you just plop down these institutions, people would behave as the authors of these formal models or constitutional laws expected them to behave, that was missing something. So the pendulum swung back in the opposite direction, and the idea became very important that legacies matter. Right? So it mattered that these countries were post-communist countries, not that they happened to just be countries 1 through 26 plopped down in a particular place. However, our sense when we started this project was that the legacies literature was characterized by sort of an ad hoc approach to how legacies mattered. Mostly you would find people referencing legacies when they were studying something else and they were getting to their explanation, and they would bring in the past as part of the explanation for that. What you ended up was a lot of sort of single country stories that would reference some episode of communism in the past to tell a story about what was going on in that country. And then oddly enough, for a literature that in a sense was based on proving that communism mattered, most of the studies were within the region. There was no comparison with countries outside of the post-communist region. Finally, most of the work in this literature, and a lot of which has been very interesting, was on the effect of legacies on institutions. So things like levels of democracy, corruption, central bank independence, but not really on individual level behavior. So that's the motivation, that's one motivation for our process, this idea that yes, legacies matter, but we lack the systematic framework for thinking about how legacies might matter. Moreover, when you start to look at public opinion and you start to look at attitudes towards politics and economics, and actually when you look at a host of other things that aren't in the book manuscript as well, such as left-right self-placement, evaluation of political parties, we've written about this elsewhere, you find that there are these systematic differences in attitudes among post-communist citizens. And there are systematic differences in the way that we would expect based on sort of communist dogma and the sort of message proposed by the Soviet system. I'll explain where all this data comes from much later, but these are very simple bivariate regressions, but they basically show there's less support for democracy among post-communist citizens, less support for market economies, more support for the government being responsible for individual social welfare. So this is in line with what we might expect coming out of communism. All right. So the goals of our book manuscript, of which I'm going to show you a piece of the research today, is that one, we want to demonstrate whether these differences that I just kind of quickly showed you in these bivariate frameworks, whether they really do or do not exist. And then, to the extent that they do exist, we want to come up with a theoretical explanation to see if these differences are a result of communist-era legacies, or to explain why these differences in attitudes and opinions exist. So we want to have theoretical explanations, and we want to test these theories in a sort of rigorous manner to be able to evaluate which of these theoretical explanations for why we see these differences of opinions and attitudes in post-communist citizens are most supported by empirical data. And overall, and also we want to sort of develop a method, we wanted to develop a methodological approach for doing so. And overall, the idea was to move the literature forward from a series of sort of individual studies of places where we can see legacy effects to a more sort of built up from first principles systematic framework for thinking about the way in which the past could affect the present generally, but also the way in which the past, the communist past, could affect attitudes in the post-communist present. And then hopefully as a field with this kind of systematic framework out there, we could provide some initial evidence in some areas, but people could use this framework to continue studying various questions that would be of interest to them. All right, so why study this in the post-communist world as opposed to somewhere else, as opposed to, say, only looking at all authoritarian regimes or looking at different characteristics? I probably don't have to convince this audience of this, but the region really has a lot of attractive features for trying to study the effect of legacies. First of all, we have a distinctive set of shared political and economic institutions. We have these 26 countries that enter post-communism having had fairly similar, not identical, to be very clear, I'm not claiming that any of this was identical, but as far as sort of historical examples of having lots of countries with shared institutions, you had similar political and economic institutions, but crucially for identification strategies, you also had significant differences in pre-communist economic, political, and cultural legacies. And on top of this, one of the biggest problems to ever try and study legacy effects of regimes is, of course, that when you get a regime transition, maybe the reason you got that regime transition was because the attitude that you think is the legacy effect was already sort of creeping in. So you have these problems with how you identify these models, and what you really want is some exogenous factor that comes along and institutes the regime change, and then you can look at the effect of the legacy. And again, it's not completely exogenous, but probably in the history of the world, the sort of collapse of communism as it snowballs through Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union is one of the highest degrees of exogeneity that we're ever going to see in the kind of rise and fall of a particular regime type. Same thing for when sort of the Soviet army marched to the West and left behind all these communist regimes in its wake. So we have a high degree of exogeneity and rise and fall of communists, probably the best we'll ever get in the real world. It's not perfect. Moreover, when people study legacy effects, say, in Latin America for military regimes, we're sometimes looking at 5-year, 10-year exposure to the treatment effects. With communism, you get this real strong exposure to the treatment effect, right? We have these 45-year doses or the 70-year doses of communism. So again, if we're looking to study the effect of a legacy effect of a regime, we get these long doses. There's also significant variation in post-communist political and economic trajectories. Moreover, for people who don't like cross-national analysis, which is what the vast majority of my talk is going to be about today, we actually also have the opportunity to conduct a different type of methodological study, which is to look at variation within a country, where we have in Germany, we have part of the country that's exposed to communism and part of the country that isn't. And then finally, again, this is the wrong crowd to have to make this claim for, but you know, for us, we had sort of this inherent interest in the lasting effects of what's arguably the largest social and political experiment ever, certainly in the 20th century, but probably perhaps ever in the history of the world. Maybe the Catholic Church is the one thing that rivals this, or Islam. But beyond sort of religious things, this is probably the largest social political experiment. We want to know, does it have lasting effects? And finally, we think it's important for understanding post-communist politics to get a handle on how the past matters. Okay, now, that's why we're studying this with post-communist countries as opposed to other conceptions. The framework, though, could be used in different ways. All right, so with that argument out there, with the sort of justification out there, let's now turn to our sort of theoretical approach. And here's the crux of our argument. As I told you from the beginning, we have this stylized fact where we find that there are these differences in attitudes in post-communist countries than you find in citizens in the rest of the world. So there are lots of different reasons we could come up with for why we might find differences in attitudes among citizens in post-communist countries and citizens elsewhere. However, our argument is that at its base level, we can divide this into sort of two general ideas here. The first idea is that the divergence could be due to contextual effects. So the divergence could be due to the situation in which the citizens of post-communist countries find themselves living. And that if you put other people in those same circumstances who hadn't lived through communism, they would hold similar views. And I'll explain this in much more detail momentarily. But the basic idea is it's the context in which people are living that explains the views. The second set of arguments, which is a fundamentally different argument, is that you get divergence in views because people who are living in post-communist countries, or most of them anyway, lived through communism. That it's not simply the conditions of the post-communist world, it's the experience of actually living through communism that inculcated sets of attitudes among people who lived through communist rule. All right, so let's go into this in more detail. Starting with contextual factors. We're going to say, again, there's lots and lots of things that you could consider in contextual factors, but we're going to try to break these down into a few useful categories to wrap our heads around. One of these could be demographic factors, right? So let's just imagine that the state of the world is such that the only thing that determines attitudes towards social welfare, whether or not you think there should be more state-provided social welfare, is if you are the amount of education you have and your employment status. And that the more educated you are and the less employed you are, the more likely you are to think the state should provide social welfare. Okay? If that was the state of the world, if that was the real way the world functioned, that just highly educated people and unemployed people wanted more social welfare, and it turned out that because of post-communist transitions, the situation and because of communist emphasis on education, that in the 2000s and the 1990s, post-communist countries just had disproportionately more overeducated and underemployed people in them, then when we looked at the aggregate, you would get that stylized fact I showed you. On aggregate, more citizens in post-communist countries would support social welfare spending by the state or would favor a more activist state than you would find elsewhere. But it would have nothing to do with having lived through communism per se. It just has to do with the fact that there's this demographic characteristic that determines attitudes, and that particular demographic characteristic is more prevalent in post-communist countries. Similarly, it could be that attitudes are driven by economic factors. We often think this is the case, right? So maybe the story is simply that people prefer the government to provide more social welfare when economic conditions are worse. If at the time of the surveys that we're looking at, economic conditions are systematically worse in post-communist countries, then you might expect to find more support for social welfare in post-communist countries. And when we started working on this project, which was a while ago, I would say something now at this point in the talk. Imagine, hypothetically speaking, that you saw a collapse of one-third of GDP in a West European country. Maybe then you would have more demand for social welfare in West European countries. That doesn't have anything to do with living through communism, right? So we now have lived through this world. So that's the idea here. It could also be about political institutions or political outcomes, right? Maybe, and again, I'm just sort of talking on the, you know, this is not an actual argument here, but maybe what the way the world works is simply that people who live in parliamentary systems of government are more in favor of greater social welfare spending, and people who live in presidential systems are less in favor of greater social welfare spending. And if you have more parliamentary systems in post-communist countries, again, that could explain the distinction. The key factor here for all of these contextual facts, and we organize them by demographic, economic, and political for conceptual reasons, but the key factor is that all these factors could explain why post-communist citizens have different views without recourse to the idea that it was something about living through communism and having a set of attitudes and beliefs inculcated while living under communist rule, right? They just have to do with the context in which people are living. All right. Now, the next question becomes, which of these contextual factors are legacies, right? So this is a little bit more complicated. So some contextual factors are legacies, but some contextual factors, we would say, are not legacies. And here what we use to rely to sort of split this out and think about this is we're going to rely on temporal sequence here. So pre-communist factors, anything that has to do that predates the imposition of communism, if that was able to explain why these distinctions and attitudes held, that would not be a legacy of communism. So again, imagine a state of the world where the only thing that determines attitudes towards social welfare spending is whether you is how far you live from the equator. The colder it gets, the more you want the state to provide social welfare spending, right? If it turns out that communist countries are actually just farther from the equator than a lot of countries, right, that and that's the factor that explains this divergence in attitude, that's not a legacy of communism, right? That's a prior legacy. Something that if we can study the way the world is at the very end of communism in 1989, that's definitely not a legacy of post-communism, right? And to the extent that we could actually control for everything about the pre-communist world perfectly in our models, which we can't, but if we could, then measuring the way the world was at the end of communism, that would be our best measure of communist era effects, right? If we could adequately control for pre-communism that didn't explain away the distinction, and then we controlled for the way the world was in 1989 and that did explain the distinction, that would be a perfect evidence of a communist era legacy. Then we get to contemporaneous indicators, like what the world is like at the time people are taking the surveys. And these are going to be, just by definitional, they're going to be results of both communism and post-communism. But we can use a bit of common sense to think through this, right? Some things are going to be more communism than post-communism. If I'm looking at the percentage of people living in urban areas in 1993, that's basically a legacy of communist era urbanization policies, and it's much less about post-communist policies. Some are going to be more post-communist than communism. If countries choose to institute PR rules, proportional representation rules in electing legislatures, instead of single-member districts, that's largely a decision that's made in the post-communist context. And some are going to be probably close to equal influences, right? If I'm measuring the unemployment rate in Poland in 1997, that's in part based on decisions made by Poland's post-communist governments, but it's part about the long accumulated overhang of communism that led to the economic crisis that led to the decisions they made. All right. So that's how these contextual factors relate to legacies. But we have this alternate explanation. And the alternate explanation is that it's not about context. It's not just if you placed other people in these circumstances, would they hold the same views? It's about something having to do with actually living through communism. And here the argument is that possibly it is about socialization, that the communist regime actively tried to inculcate a set of values among its citizens, and that with the disappearance of communism, those values don't just puff out of people's minds. All right, why might we expect this to be a possibility? First of all, there's this longstanding political science literature on socialization. And in this literature, there's a lot of useful things that are out there. You know, there are arguments that regimes attempt to inculcate citizens with a set of values. There are arguments made in this literature that this process can occur across multiple agents, including schools. There's arguments about socialization varying across certain subsections of the population. And there's this all interesting ongoing debate about whether socialization is a process that occurs throughout one's whole life, or it's a process that takes place earlier in childhood. But there is this outstanding argument that regimes want their citizens to hold certain values. So we've got that literature. The second thing, of course, is that if there was ever a regime out there that we might think tried to inculcate a set of values among its citizens, it would be Soviet communism, right? This was a regime that had a sort of worldview that it was representing, that it was arguing it ruled on behalf of, but also that it was actively trying to inculcate in the citizenry. And this is the socialist man sort of project here. Now, we have socialist man in theory, right? We can think about political rule by the proletariat, economic with state, not market-run economies, social welfare guaranteed by the states. In terms of social policy, rights of women, such as legal abortion and minorities, are guaranteed to be protected. Socialist man in practice, a little bit different, right? Politically, you had rule by the Communist Party. The economic, you had state-run economies, but varying degrees of market-based activity by country and period. And you had real social welfare benefits. Although, of course, we had some who were more equal than others, and the record on women's rights and minorities' rights are mixed. All right. So then what we try to do is we say, okay, let's pull this together. If we think, and here's where what we tried to sort of take the next step forward. We said, okay, if we think that its exposure to communism, this socialization process that accounts for these attitudes, how would we know if we were right? What would be the observable implication of this? It sounds plausible, but if we wanted to measure this, how would we possibly know whether we were right or wrong in this regard? And so we try to think, what's the most basic, simplest, observable implication of this? And what we came up with was to say, look, if it's right that it's exposure to communism that matters, then whatever the attitude in question that we think the regime that you're getting socialized to accept, in the case of the data I'm going to show you here being more in favor of the state providing social welfare, right? If you are exposed to it for a longer period of time, you should be more likely to hold that attitude, or more likely to hold that attitude in a stronger format. That seemed to us the simplest idea. If it's exposure to communism, then being exposed for 45 years should have more of an effect than being exposed for a day. And within that, you know, 5 years should have more of an effect than 10 years, and 10 years should have more, five years should have less of an effect than 10 years, 10 less than 15, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so that's where we started with this project. We said, can we find that these attitudes in question are held or become stronger or are more likely to be held as a function of exposure to more years of communism? But of course, when we first started presenting it, especially when we presented it to audiences like these who were specialized in post-communism or communist countries or Russian history and all these sorts of things, right, immediately we get to the point that, well, not all years of exposure to communism are created equally. So we began to think systematically about how we could incorporate this into our theoretical arguments. And we actually ended up, after working through a lot of things, and Scott was enormously helpful for this at a book manuscript conference where we did, and we had lots of different ways we tried to work through this, but we've eventually sort of settled in on this idea of actually taking our cue from medical science, and in particular from sunburn. If you think about exposure to the sun and getting sunburn, right? Now, putting aside for a moment the normative implications of referring to communism as a sunburn, the analogy here still kind of holds, right? If you're exposed to an hour, you're always going to think you're more likely to get exposed to, more likely to get burned the longer you're exposed to the sun. However, if you're exposed to an hour of sun, say in February in Madison, Wisconsin, right, as opposed to an hour of sun, say, on a beach in Greece in the middle of August, you would expect to be more likely to get sunburned from the hour of sun on the beach in Greece in August.
Get frostbite.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't say your skin wouldn't turn colors, right? But similarly, conditional on standing on a beach in Greece for 4 hours in the middle of the afternoon in August, whether you're wearing suntan lotion or not will affect your likelihood of getting burned as well. So we argued that, yes, it's temporal exposure. That's our best observable implication of this. But that this could vary in terms of intensity, and it could also vary in terms of resistance. And then our second innovation in this regard was to say, look, we can think about the factors that might affect intensity of exposure and resistance to exposure as varying both across political systems, across countries, and across individuals, right? So I'll give you more examples of this as we go forward. But the basic idea here is that we use this framework to think about intensifiers of exposure and resistance to exposure, and to think about things that might affect this at the country level and the individual level to create this communist regime exposure socialization model. All of these are factors that we're going to include in the analysis that I'm going to show you, except the ones that are boxed. Those are things that we like as ideas, but we didn't have the data on. But the one thing I just want to draw your attention to is, like, this allows us to bring in different variations in communist regimes, right? This allows us to take account of the fact that we might think the socialization message would be stronger under Stalinism, right, than it is under perestroika. One thing I'll note is that when we started this project, and I always say this in conferences, we started this project and once we got to this point, we said, okay, we really got to take account of the differences across the different types of communism. We then said, okay, let's go find the historian who has written the paper that breaks down communism into reform communism, Stalinism, neo-Stalinism across these different regimes. And we couldn't find it. And we looked and we couldn't find it. And I've been giving these talks for what now is years. I've always put up the slide that we had at the time and said, if anybody in the audience has written this article and we're not citing it, let me know. We'd be happy to cite it. We'd be happy to see what's out there. I've crowdsourced this. I've given this table out at talks and invited people to write back to us and give us if they thought we had better improvements of it. I crowdsourced it. I put it on the monkey cage back in the old days when we were independent and the comments were very constructive and I asked people for suggestions and did they have ideas and things like that. So this is a crowdsource activity, but this is what we came up with. And hopefully this kind of data will actually be useful for other people for studies that they're doing. But that's been done by us with a lot of help from our friends. Okay, so pulling it all together conceptually, where are we? We live in a world where when you look across big cross-national studies, post-communist citizens do indeed hold systematically different attitudes on fundamental aspects of political economy that are in line with what we would think from the sort of Soviet message. And what we want to know is what can explain this divergence in attitudes. Is it contextual effects? And if it is contextual effects, are these sort of pre-communist factors about where communism took root? Are they factors that were at the end of communism? Or are they factors that are sort of contemporaneous, and to the extent that they're contemporaneous, socio-demographic, economic, or political? If it's not something that we can just explain away with contextual effects, then the thing that seems most, the next most credible explanation after this is that there's some socialization mechanism at work. And if we think there was some socialization mechanism at work, well then the best thing we could come up with for finding observable evidence of this was that it should increase the longer you're exposed to communism. So can we account for this divergence in attitudes based on temporal exposure to communism? And that this, we realize and we'll try to build into our work, could vary in intensity in terms of resistance, and these could vary at the country and the individual level. So that's the goal. We're going to try to explain divergence in attitudes. So now I'm going to bring you back to the substantive topic. That's the argument we're making in the book. That's the theoretical framework we're testing in the book. Now I'm going to show you the results from one chapter. I'll tell you how we're going to do this. So now putting it all together, the empirical strategy. All right, so our empirical strategy is as follows. What we're going to do is we are going to begin with cross-regional analysis. We're going to rely on really big surveys that involve countries that ask the same set of survey questions in countries that are post-communist countries and countries that are not post-communist countries. And we're going to, in order to identify these models, we're going to use surveys that ask these questions at multiple periods of time, that carry out the surveys repeatedly in countries. Because there are issues, if we only had one survey in one point of time, it would be very hard to disentangle age from exposure to communism. So we're looking for big cross-national surveys that allow us to look at attitudes in both post-communist countries and other countries. And we're going to do what I did on that very first chart I showed you, which is just have a very simple model and establish whether there's a difference. We'll do that by including what's called a dummy variable in the model, which identifies all the individuals in the sample who are in post-communist countries. And we're going to control only for the year of the survey in case the world was changing in ways across the years of these surveys. Then what we're going to do is we're going to add our pre-communist variables. Because of the way multiple regression works, if our pre-communist variables are what's actually driving these systematic differences, then we would see the post-communist dummy variable disappear. The effect would go to, the variable would go to zero, the statistical significance would differ. So we're going to look at the post-communist dummy variable. Then we're going to do the same thing for our end of communism variables, observe the post-communist dummy variable. We're going to add the contemporaneous variables, we observe the dummy variable. Then we add years of exposure, controlling for age. This is the key thing. So when we look at years of exposure, we're going to control for how old people are. And we're going to observe the effects of years of exposure in the post-communist dummy variable. Then, at that point, when we start to talk about factors that intensify and the resistance for exposure, at that point it no longer makes sense to have the countries that are not post-communist countries in there. So at that point, we'll move to intra-regional analysis. And we're going to examine the effect of the regime level intensifying and resistance variables and the individual level intensifying resistance variables. That's the main bulk of the analysis, but we supplement this analysis with lots of other things to try to get things. So I'll explain the supplementary analysis as we get to it. So in chapter 6, we're looking at this theoretical framework to explain divergence and support for social welfare. Our expectation is that socialist man is more supportive of state responsibility for social welfare. The data, the first part of the data that I'm going to show you is from something called the World Value Surveys, and it looks at, we use four waves of data, surveys that were carried out all the way from 1989 to 2009, which gives us a total of 211 surveys from 87 countries. 68 of these surveys are from 24 different post-communist countries, which we're going to supplement with all those contextual level data, which is this big data set that we've built up to do this over the years. At the end, I'm going to show you some supplementary analysis from two other surveys. One is a life and transition survey, and one is a Hungarian household panel survey. But we're going to start first with World Value Survey. Our dependent variable is an index that we create out of data, out of a number of different questions to try to measure support for state-provided social welfare. And the statistical model is ordinary least squares with country error, clustered errors, and equilibrated survey weights. We've also rerun these models in many times using hierarchical models, and we find no substantive differences, which is what you would expect from the structure of the data. Okay. I am not going to read this slide. These are all the variables up here, but you see this whole huge collection of pre-communist variables. You can thank Scott for that. When we did this at our book manuscript conference, we were reamed over the coals for not having nearly enough pre-communism variables. We went back and collected all sorts of additional data on this, and actually a lot of this is due to having those. The takeaway point from this slide is simply when we say we're trying to saturate the model with contextual variables, we really went as far as we could to try to get as much data here to see if we could make these variables disappear. For those of you who are do quantitative analysis, you may look at this and say, well, I would expect some of these things to co-vary with each other. And that's absolutely correct. Some of these do co-vary with each other. But the idea here is that we're not looking at the statistical significance on any of these variables. We're just saying if when we saturate the model, we can make the dummy variable disappear. All right. Here is the key basic finding on the contextual results. Now, the way to read this table is essentially these models are huge, but these models have lots of variables in them. So what we have in this model here is just everything here shows what we're including in the models. And then the key thing, remember, what we're looking at is what happens to this dummy variable. Does it disappear? So this is the result I showed you at the beginning of the talk, only controlling for the year of the survey. We find post-communist citizens more supportive of social welfare. We add pre-communist controls, it doesn't go away. I'll skip this for 1 second. We add post-communist, late communist, pre-communist controls, late communist, doesn't go away, it even gets bigger. We add in all our contemporary variables, doesn't go away. We do it with Germany, we get basically the same effect, this positive effect. And then these two models here are something really cool. They're called entropy balancing, and it's a new way to think about dealing with, it's called synthetic control analysis. You try to simulate as if you were done an experiment. Anyway, we do entropy balancing. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but that doesn't make the results do anything different. Bottom line here, despite my initial proclivities when I went into going to do this project, that what was going to happen was we were going to take account of the post-communist economic context and all these differences were going to go away, they don't. We have no support here for the contextual variables. The only thing we find is that actually, when you add in one thing to take away from here, when you add in post-communist political institutions, that actually cuts the deficit basically in half. So there does seem to be some effect for post-communist political institutions. But at the end of the day, when we include the fully saturated model, we actually have a bigger deficit or a bigger surplus of support for social welfare than we did when we started. And these are substantively meaningful differences here. The standard deviation of this index is about 3. And so when you're looking at a variable of 1, what you're saying is simply by dint, with all these variables, all the things that go into affect public opinion, simply by dint of being a post-communist citizen, being exactly identical to someone who's not a post-communist citizen in all their ways, shifts you a third of a standard deviation in your attitudes towards social welfare. So it's a substantively meaningful shift. All right, so now we have to entertain the socialization hypothesis. And so what we find here, we start off these models here, and in each of these pairs of model, the first model keeps our post-communist dummy variable in, and the second model uses what's called country-fixed effects, at which point we drop out the post-communist dummy variable. What we find here is that when we look at exposure, so in the first model, we simply look at, we're still in our cross-regional comparison here, but we simply look at total years of communist exposure, including all the other control variables we have. So as soon as we enter into years of communist exposure, our post-communist dummy variable now drops dramatically. It's no longer statistically significant. And sure enough, an additional year of communist exposure is positive, it's significant, it's in the direction that we expect it to be, right? So we originally find out, right, that exposure matters, it's in the correct direction, it reduces the size of the post-communist dummy variable substantially, and again, it's substantively meaningful. Now, next, what we do is we say, okay, and this was very robust across the country fixed effects model and the regular model. The next thing we do is we say, okay, let's start thinking about this types of regime types. So we break it up into exposure to Stalinism, neo-Stalinism, post-totalitarianism, and reform communism. And our expectation in all of these cases is that we would see a stronger effect under Stalinism than we would for exposure to reform communism and sort of post-totalitarianism. And interestingly, while we find that in other chapters, in this particular chapter on social welfare, we don't find that at all. In fact, it seems that exposure to the sort of softer communism has just as strong an effect, in some cases, depending on the non-fixed effect model, it's even stronger than the exposure to Stalinism. And this is an interesting finding. I mean, it falsifies our idea that these different times are mattering differently. It does potentially suggest that due to the fact that maybe this is about social welfare, there may be a sort of nostalgia effect, right, for the good old days, which weren't quite as bad as things were under Stalinism, but where we had basic services provided and education was free and healthcare is free. We can't prove any of that is what's going on here. It's sort of suggested by these findings, and it was kind of an interesting finding that we didn't necessarily expect. But this kind of, it's not, you know, it's sort of, it's not in line with the more intense being the Stalinism anyway, which we find in some other chapters. All right. Then what we do is we break this down by adult exposure and childhood exposure. And for those of you who've looked at the political socialization literature in the US, the story is all about, is it only childhoods or childhood and adult? What we find here is that, interestingly enough, it appears to be more adult than childhood. So again, and we did this, and we've been suggested that we should check out interaction effects here and look at the interaction between adult and childhood, but that doesn't seem to particularly matter. So if this finding holds up, it's kind of an interesting finding in this, insofar as it's not what we had expected to see from the literature on established democracies. It might pertain to something having to do with citizens when they entered adult years realizing sort of the importance of communism is a pragmatic ideology in terms of advancing careers, advancing life, and that these messages became inculcated more during adult years than they did during childhood years. I don't want to make a huge deal out of this. There's some weird things about the early communist exposure, just because since this lasted for such a long period of time, there's an awful lot of people in the data set who get the full treatment, who have all 12 years here. And so what you're really comparing is people who lived through their entire childhood in communism to people who were born after communism or born at the end of communism, people who were born before, and there may be something distinctive about those cohorts. So I'm not willing to say this overturns conventional socialization theory about childhood importance, but there is something interesting going on there. Okay, now what we do is we then interact with all these different resistance and strength variables that I showed you. Now we're looking just at communist citizens. These tables get more and more complex. I'm not even going to bother going through the tables on them, but I'll show you a couple of pictures. The bottom line is in this chapter, there's not a whole lot going on with these resistance and strengthening variables. We do find one thing that we thought would actually strengthen resistance, having communism imposed on you, actually works in the opposite way that we expected. An additional year of exposure for countries where communism was imposed has a stronger effect than with homegrown communism. That was against what we were expecting. We do find, as per what we thought, that living in an urban country leads to having an additional year of urban area of the country leads to having an additional year having more of an effect than living in a rural area. And then one of the recurring things we find through lots of these chapters is that Catholicism seems to offer resistance towards additional years of exposure having a cumulative effect on adopting sort of pro-communist attitudes. So you do see a much bigger effect for years of exposure, to communism for people who are Eastern Orthodox and people who are Catholic. Now, this raises the question. If it is exposure, what's the mechanism? Right? So what did this? Right? It's not simply breathing the air under communism that does this. So what is it? And we, this is the question which at the beginning of the project we didn't think we were going to have to wrestle with because we didn't think we were going to find it being exposure. But now that we have gotten to exposure, we have to think about what this is, right? So what's the mechanism? So we're trying to zero in on a couple of things that seem particularly important to us. And if you bear with me just for a few more minutes, we'll do, I'll show you some much newer stuff that we've done now that goes outside of our original framework to try to look at whether it's a story of Communist Party membership and what the role of parental socialization seems to play in all of this. So first, let's look at Communist Party membership. This is data from a different survey. This is the European Bank for Recovery and Development's Leadership in Transition Surveys. It was two waves conducted in 2006 and 2010, and it involves 63 surveys from 35 countries, including 57 surveys from 30 post-communist countries. So it has great geographic coverage across the post-communist world, better than the World Value Survey. Many fewer non-post-communist countries, but the ones that are in it are West European countries. But what's cool about this survey is they asked about parental Communist Party membership. So we're able to look at this. So in the first model, we created another social welfare index. And what was really great about this is with totally different data from a totally different survey, we're able to replicate our basic finding. An additional year of communist exposure does lead to more support for social welfare spending. So that's always comforting when you have a giant survey project and you go to another big survey project and you can find the same finding. Now, in the second column, what we did is we added Communist Party membership. Now, remember, the thought here is maybe the reason why exposure to communism is making people adapt these views is that there's a whole bunch of people running around communist countries who are members of the Communist Party, and when they're in the Communist Party, they're getting exposed to Communist Party doctrine and Communist Party dogma, and they're going to party meetings, and they're being promoted by dint of being good communists, so they're more likely to pick up these attitudes, right? So the first thing we check is to say, okay, are the people who were actually in the Communist Party more likely to be supportive of social welfare? Here, big thumbs up. So far, so good. Right, we do see people who were in the Communist Party that they actually were more are more supportive of social welfare. So that's consistent with the idea that maybe the mechanism is going through the Communist Party. But there's a potential problem here, which is maybe it's selection bias. Maybe the people who are more pro-communist attitudes are more likely to join the Communist Party. And sure enough, when we go to the next one, which is the kicker, we look at the interaction between your being a member of the Communist Party and years of communist exposure. If this was the mechanism that was driving this exposure effect, this should be positive and statistically significant, and it should wash out the effect for people who weren't in the Communist Party. It's not. So this is disappointing, or if disappointing in the sense if you thought you're close to figuring out what the story is, it doesn't, from this particular set of analyses, seems to be Communist Party membership that drives this. We do some other stuff here. We're running short on time. I'm going to skip it with mothers and fathers and things like that. But I do want to point to model number 5 here, which is really interesting. It doesn't really tell us anything about the story that we're trying to tell here. But it turns out that, as I said a moment ago, people who are in the Communist Party are, in the post-communist era, much more in favor of social welfare spending on the part of the state, or redistribution on the part of the state. However, it turns out if your parents were in the Communist Party, you're less likely to support social welfare spending, right? So what this is totally consistent with, and actually anti the idea that this is a parental socialization transmitting these communist values, this is a self-interested political economy story. Your parents were communist. You exit the post-communist period with a bunch of goodies. You don't want to see the state confiscating them and redistributing them at this point, right? So this is a really interesting political economy thing that also doesn't really give us a heads up on why communist exposure seems to matter, but it does explain why children might be sort of different in this regard. Okay. Finally, we have one other survey that we can take account of here that we can use to look more detail at this idea of parental socialization. So there's going to be a lot of moving pieces here, and probably too many. And we should find a way to more concisely display this. But let me try to explain to you what's going on here in as clear a way as possible. This is really recent work. We've just done this recently. We just got a hold of this data. So think of it this way. We can think of parental transmission of attitudes working in two different ways. One way is the parents hold the pro-regime position, and they transmit that pro-regime position to their children. The other is the parents are opposed to the regime, and they transmit that opposition to their children. Right? So in this case, we're going to see if parents who the parents are pro-social welfare, the children also end up being pro-social welfare. And we're going to see if parents who were anti-social welfare, the children also end up being anti-social welfare. Now, based on socialization theory, again, we think there are factors that might moderate this. What are some of the factors? One is the age of the child. We think these socialization effects might be stronger on younger children. And the second is household characteristics. So things like whether your parent was a member of the Communist Party and your religion of your household are things we might think. Now, the data that we have to test this are really unique. This is the Hungarian Household Panel Survey, and it's six waves of a survey from 1992 to 97 that included interviews with every person in the house who was over the age of 16. So we're able to ask the children and the parents the same question, and we are able to ask them this six different times over a relatively short period of time. So the actual analysis we do, I can go through this quickly, but again, we have to use some, we don't have the perfect social welfare question, but we use a couple of different questions about unemployment, whether unemployment should be tolerated because you need it to solve some economic problems, and then whether unemployment benefits should be increased, kept the same, or decreased. And the independent variables we're going to use in this is we're going to look at parents' attitudes as predictors of their children's attitudes, and in a couple analyses we'll use children's previous attitudes. And we have And we have demographic control variables. Crucially, in our demographic control variable, we have the variable that could explain both parents and children simultaneously preferring more social welfare spending or not preferring more social welfare spending, which is change in household income, right? So we want to be careful here. We're going to argue that we're trying to get at how much parents are giving their views to children. So we want to get at things that might simultaneously be influencing both the views of parents and children. The caveat in all this is that as kids get older, they tend to move out of the house, hopefully, right? And then the ones who don't move out of the house probably get more distinct from the rest of the population at that point. And we do see a big drop-off as you get older with the proportion of children who are living with their parents by, you know, as the age goes up. But there are still some older. Okay. So rather than show you any tables right now, I'm just going to show you figures. So let me show you this here. So what this is basically saying is these are point estimates with confidence intervals around them. So this is our best guess what the effect is. And this is our measures of uncertainty. And this bar here, this is our how much you change in the probability that you reject unemployment. So on the right side, you're increasing the probability that you reject unemployment in any circumstances. On the left, you're accepting some unemployment to solve economic problems. This is the pro-regime version. This is the anti-communist regime version, right? And what we find is that in our first analysis, if both parents are anti-regime, the children end up being more of the anti-regime position, and if both parents are pro-regime, children end up being more pro-regime. Of course, when you look at two contemporaneous indicators, we can't rule out endogeneity, which is that the reverse causation that the kids are causing the parents' value. So then for the rest of our analyses, what we switch to is losing a lagged variable of the parents' position. So we use the parents' position at the previous time and the children's position right now. And this way, we're ruling out the fact that it's the children causing the parent because we have them from different time periods. What we see when we move to this analysis, we find, okay, that we again find the same pattern, but now we're getting asymmetry here where the effect seems to be stronger for the anti-regime position, whereas for the pro-regime position, it's still to the right of the anti, but it's not really statistically distinguishable from zero. In our next analysis, what we look at is we now say to be even more conservative about problems of reverse causation and endogeneity, we now also control for what the respondent thought at the last time. So now we're really just seeing, does the parent's effect have an effect on how much the respondent has updated themselves, how much the child has updated since the last time in the survey? What we find, thankfully, is that there's strong consistency between the respondent's, the child's position in the previous time and now. But even in this incredibly conservative framework, having parents who held the anti-regime viewpoint that unemployment's okay in this case still makes you more opposed to social welfare. We're running short on time. We do more robustness tests across both of these things. This is called a diff and diff format. Here, this is even more conservative in some ways. We just look at the change in the parent and the change in the child. Again, similar patterns. To show you something, show you things really quickly so we can wrap up, we now then, having established this, we sort of break it down in these categories, these factors that we think might mitigate effects. We look at the youngest children, then we look at older children, then we look at the oldest ones. And we do see it in this particular case, we do see this stronger effect of the socialization effect on younger children than we do on older children. And we also find, we don't find actually what we expect with the Communist Party. This is really kind of strange. With the Communist Party, we find more of a socialization effect with children who are from non-Communist Party households than we do with children who are from Communist Party households. You can read your own thing into this. You know, maybe there's some sort of sense of kids whose parents were in the Communist Party are trying to distance themselves from their parents when we get into the post-communist era. Maybe, I'm not sure exactly what's going on. But this is, again, remember I showed you a minute ago, we were sort of not thinking it was Communist Party membership was the mechanism. This is even more evidence of that probably barking up the wrong tree. In Catholic households, we find that the anti-regime position is actually more forcefully transmitted to children, but also the pro-regime position. So Catholicism, there seems to be more of an effect going on. And then finally, this is also has to do with mothers and fathers, which I'm going to skip right now. Okay, so conclusions, wrapping up by 5 o'clock. The contextual variables only explain a bit of the post-communist excess welfare support. The most important seems to be post-communist political institutions and performance, and pre-communist controls actually enhance the social welfare deficit. So this is a sort of resounding rejection of the contextual variables as an explanation, which, may I add, is consistent across the book manuscript, much to my surprise. Exposure to communism, however, explains a great deal, but it's surprisingly uniform across regime type, which was a bit of a surprise to us. There's some evidence of variation in intensity of exposure, with it being stronger among adults and stronger among urban residents. Resistance matters as well, mainly among Catholics. There are these surprising Communist Party membership effects. Personal membership increases support for social welfare, but only among men. Maternal, skip that. There's strong parental socialization effects in Hungary. These are stronger for minors, for the youngest. They're also stronger for the non-mainstream, the sort of counter-current views, especially among Catholics. They're oddly weaker among Communist parties and stronger in general for Catholics. Anyway, that's the end of the talk. This is what the book looks like. These are the chapters that are in the book. Some of them are completed right now. But basically, what you just saw here on attitudes towards egalitarianism and responsibility for social welfare, that sort of analysis is replicated on attitudes towards states and markets, attitudes towards democracy, and attitudes towards social policy, each one having a sort of different supplementary endpoint where we explore in greater detail some questions relating to that topic. And then this chapter 8 is we're going to try, again, working on disentangling out all sorts of ideas about what it is about communism that leads people to hold these attitudes. And then finally, we'll be looking at communist legacies and the passage of time in the conclusion. So thank you very much for your time and effort. I appreciate your attention here.